We are at the home stretch, as some people have told me. They say, we're at the home stretch, right? We've had a great time. I really appreciated all the comments that people have made and the encouragement received here. It's been very wonderful and gratifying. Thank you for all that support of the work that we do through subscription and financial support as well, and prayers. I know people pray for the ministry. We deeply appreciate that. So yes, here we are at the home stretch. Okay, part two, session five. Our next speaker, Rod Dreher. He's written a book about some saint, an optional saint, I think. Sainthood is not optional, is it? Or it? No. He's the senior editor at the American Conservative. He's written and edited for New York Post, Dallas Morning News, National Review, South Florida Sun Sentinel, and many other places. He's also a contributing editor of Touchstone and author of The Benedict Option, obviously. It's one of the reasons many of us are here. He's also written Crunchy Cons and The Little Way of Ruthie Lemming, which is a very, very touching book, I've read it, and it's very moving. And please welcome Rod Dreher.
Thank you. Okay. Well, thank you all so much. We're here at the very end, and it has been such a great thing for me too. I was up till almost 2 o'clock this morning, getting caught up with old friends. You think you're going to bed, and then you meet somebody you hadn't seen for a while, and then you're talking, and then you're both wound up, and then one of you looks at the watch like, oh my gosh, you got to go to bed. And these are what these conferences are about, these moments. And I think that these speeches are just the lanyard, the little something extra, the real blessing of the conference. I've found it comes in the conversations. So thank you all for that. Thanks everybody to whom I've had a chance to talk here. We are building the Benedict Option, slowly but surely. It is a collaborative effort, and meetings like this are part of it. I want to talk about very briefly at the beginning something someone said to me last night as we were leaving the session. The person said, I hope that the top line message that people take home from this conference is not about the dispute over Donald Trump. Well, I do too. I mean, that was just, I kind of wish I hadn't opened my mouth but last night, but as I was sitting there listening to Russell Moore talk, I was thinking about Donald Trump and what that means, because it's something I think about a lot as we see what's happening to the country. But I want to say, though, that it's absolutely the truth that whatever happens with the White House is relatively minor compared to the challenges we face. I wrote this book, The Benedict Option, finished the manuscript in October of 2016, when everybody, including me, I thought Hillary Clinton was going to win. That didn't happen. I had to go back into the manuscript, which is already locked, and revise it. The politics chapter was not quite as hopeless or as alarming as it was originally, because I wrote it with the expectation that we would have Hillary Clinton in, and you know, there would be open season on believers and pro-lifers. And now that wasn't going to happen. But I did warn, as you've read in the book, that you know, we conservatives, we Christians, can't become complacent. You know, Trump, the best I think Trump will have been able to do is buy us time to get our houses in order, because the deeper forces that are tearing our society apart, that are de-Christianizing us, that are atomizing us, those are still in play no matter who is in the White House. One time I had early in my journalism career, a friend of mine had moved from covering politics in DC to covering the currency markets, because she went to work for Bloomberg. And she said, you know, I used to think that I was writing, when I was writing about politics, I was writing about the people who ran the world, But when I started writing about the currency markets, I began to realize who really runs the world. It's the people who do these massive trades, these economic oligarchs. And she said she wouldn't have understood that beforehand because she was more geared towards writing about conventional politics, but this was the job she was given, and it opened her eyes to the deeper currents that atop which our politicians simply ride. I think that's true for the Benedict option and politics. So we have to keep our eyes, we Christians, even as we watch the political situation, as we try to discern it prayerfully and thoughtfully about what we should do, what we should not do, we also have to remember that that is by far not the most important task in front of us. The challenges that are facing us can't be solved by politics. They can barely be addressed through politics. I think the best politics can do right here, right now, is to create and protect the spaces within which the church and civil society organizations can work to rise to these challenges. Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister of Hungary, once said, addressing the limits of politics, he said, "I, as a politician, I can give you things, but I can't give you meaning." I think that's really a profound thing to say. A lot of us, both on the right and the left, look to politics for meaning, where it really can't be found. Or if you look to politics for meaning, you risk becoming a devotee of a pseudo-religion. You know, you become a social justice warrior, you become completely sold out to ideology, and you make that ideology permeate everything, the way you see the world, and you get lost. We're seeking meaning, all of us here are seeking meaning in a world that denies it. We are seeking stability in a world that makes achieving stability almost impossible. We're not going to be able to find meaning and stability in politics. I don't want to dismiss politics. They are important, but rather we need to rightly order them, you know, so we neither dismiss them entirely or give them more importance than they really deserve. One thing I've learned since publishing this book a couple years ago is that the challenge we face is global. I wrote The Benedict Option as an American Christian for American Christians. Well, now the book is in 11 languages. And everywhere I travel in Europe to give talks about the book, I hear Christians who are concerned about the issues that I talk about in this book. Maybe it's slightly different in Italy than it is in America. There are certain parts of the book that are very American. But that basic sense of living in liquid modernity, living in a time when everything is in flux, all the old the institutions, the patterns of living within which people found meaning and purpose and hope are all in flux. This is happening everywhere. And I mentioned in the first day of the conference that I recently heard Bishop Emmanuel Madueke of Nigeria, an Anglican bishop there, talk about how the Benedict option is needed there because all the young generation there has smartphones. And they're getting the same culture that is popular culture, this toxic culture that is unwinding American traditional culture, is also coming there to Nigeria. And the church leaders there don't know how to stop it. Even at the Vatican a year ago, I went to Rome, I went to Italy a year ago last month to present the Italian version of the Benedict option. My publisher arranged a meeting in Rome at the Italian Senate. They had a room there in which several academics and I were giving a little talk about the Benedict option. The star of the show was Archbishop Georg Gainsbein, who is the private secretary to Benedict XVI. And I was told by my Italian journalist friends, like, Gainsbein, whatever he says today, you can be sure that Benedict XVI approved every last word. Well, that made me so nervous because Benedict is a hero of mine, and I call him the second Benedict of the Benedict option. Okay, so Monsignor Gainsbein began his speech, and I was listening. He read it in Italian. I was listening to it on the translation. And I very nearly burst into tears because he praised the book. He said that And this was happening on 9/11, September 11th, the talk he gave. He described the abuse crisis as the 9/11 of the Catholic Church. And he went on to say about how the Benedict option was the one book that has given him more comfort than any other as he faces this, the crisis as a Catholic prelate. I was so humbled by that. I didn't know what to say, and I didn't have a chance to talk to him about it because he left after he gave his talk. But the Italian journalist said, you can be sure that he took a risk to say that because the book is hugely controversial in the Vatican. And in fact, when I was over there in Italy, some people in the Vatican whose names I wasn't given were calling around all the dioceses telling them, don't welcome Rodri into your diocese. This is dangerous stuff. So the fact that I got an endorsement from Gainsbein, which is to say Benedict XVI, that really meant a lot to me. It gave me comfort and confidence that I am and the people who take the book seriously, that we are on the right track. So the title of my talk this morning is St. Benedict, the Father of Us All. I chose that title in part to reflect on how St. Benedict of Nursia, who died in the year 547, is a father, a patriarch of the undivided church. All of us, Catholic, Orthodox, and Protestant, can look upon Benedict as a father in the faith. I also chose this title because Benedict is widely regarded as the patron saint of monasticism in the West. I would say the Celtic monks got a raw deal out of that, but nevertheless, here we are. Given the role that medieval monasticism played in the history of Western civilization, all of us men and women of the West owe an enormous debt to Benedict of Nursia, our spiritual ancestor. And I think that if we, the people in this room, can recognize Benedict as a common spiritual father, then we can understand ourselves as spiritual brothers and sisters in this shared project of figuring out how to live as exiles in this post-Christian land. When I'm asked to explain the Benedict option, I often bring up two chapters in the Old Testament, Jeremiah chapter 29 and Daniel chapter 3. In Jeremiah, the Lord speaks to the Hebrews in their Babylonian exile, assuring them that he has brought them to that faraway land for a reason, and that he will restore them to their own land in due course. In the meantime, the Lord says, settle down here, start families, pray for the peace of the city. Now, I think that applies to us too, but we should interpret that passage in light of Daniel chapter 3, which tells a story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the three Hebrew men who worked for the king of Babylon. You cannot be more embedded in Babylonian society than working for the king. They were embedded, but not assimilated. They were in that world, but they were not of that world. As we know, when those three men were ordered to pay homage to a graven idol, those Hebrew men chose the prospect of martyrdom before apostasy. They were in Babylon, but Babylon was not in them. So here's the challenge for us. We have to ask ourselves, what was it about the daily lives of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego that allowed them to take a prominent role in Babylonian society and yet keep their eyes firmly on God, such that when they were put to the test, they chose to go with what they believed was going to be martyrdom over disobedience? What was it about the way they lived every day prior to that time of testing that allowed them to make the right choice? We need to make that inquiry and find that spirit and learn how to live by that same spirit in our lives. I have a very personal story to tell you about a mistake I made because I was not living by that spirit, and it cost me dearly. Most of you here who know anything about me know that I was a very devout Roman Catholic for 13 years. I came to Christ as an adult in my mid-20s through the Catholic Church. I remember when I was living in Baton Rouge at the time, working in my first job at the local newspaper, and I felt a calling to Christ and to Christ as a Catholic. One of my colleagues, a photographer at the paper, came to me and said, oh, I hear you're interested in becoming a Catholic. Well, I'm a Catholic. I work at the Missionaries of Charity soup kitchen downtown. Why don't you come work with me sometime there? And I thought, that's a very Catholic thing to do. I'll be there. So I was the guy who lifted his head out of his copy of First Things magazine and the books I was reading about Catholic theology and went down to the soup kitchen one Saturday afternoon. I scrubbed pots, I peeled potatoes and carrots and did soup kitchen-y things. This was the Missionaries of Charity. And when it was over, I thought, you know, that was nice, but really I'm more of an intellectual. My time would be better spent reading books. Never went back to the soup kitchen. I ended up getting a job in Washington and was received into the Catholic Church at St. Matthew's Cathedral on Easter Vigil 1993. I was so proud to be a Catholic, my gosh, because I was on Team Newhouse. And again, the Catholic Church didn't do this to me. I did this to myself. Let me state that clearly. But at that time, as a young man, new in Washington, I wanted to be in the right tribe. I was a journalist at the Washington Times, conservative paper. I was a political conservative, and I was a Catholic. And as part of becoming assimilated and initiated into the Catholic tribe, Catholic conservative tribe, I had to pick out the good bishops from the bad bishops, the good writers from the bad writers. I loved it. I ate it up. And I wanted to be a good tribal Catholic. And I thought that whenever I would get into discussions with my friends, which I did often, about what was going on in the church, usually talking about church politics, who's up, who's down, you know, why won't the bishops do blah, blah, blah. I thought I was being a good Catholic. I was engaged with my faith. And the community I had surrounded myself with of usually young men, young Catholic conservative men, that's how we were. I ended up moving to New York City, got a job as a film critic there, but then moved over to become a columnist on the news section. In 2001, I started writing about the abuse scandal. This is before it broke big out of Boston. I was writing about what was going on in New York. And I interviewed this guy, Father Thomas Doyle. I mean, if you read about the scandal, you'll know that Father Tom was a very brave priest who spoke up for victims early on, and it really cost him. Well, I interviewed him for a story I was working on, and after the interview, he said, "Rod, I can tell you're a serious Catholic. I just want to warn you, if you keep going down this path, you're going to go to places darker than you can imagine." I thought, wow, well, Father, I appreciate that, but, you know, I go to Mass every week, I have frequent confession, but I feel like I have to go down this path. This battle has to be fought. I'm a Catholic, too. This church needs to be cleaned up. It's my church, and I have a young son. It needs to be cleaned up for him. Father Tom said, "Oh, absolutely, I agree with you, and I'm grateful for the work you're doing. I just want to warn you that this is going to be dark." Well, it was, and I didn't take Father Tom as seriously as I should have. I ended up spending the next 3 years writing a lot about the scandal, interviewing people, Cardinal McCarrick's had a lawyer in 2002 call my boss and told him that we know Rodrigo is going to write something about the cardinal that's embarrassing but not criminal, i.e. molesting seminarians, and we want to get him taken off that story. My boss didn't take me off the story, but I couldn't have a story because the people who were tipping me off, priests who knew about him and laymen who knew what was going on, wouldn't go on the record. But I knew McCarrick was guilty from 2002, but I couldn't write about it. Anyway, I fell into deep despair, but I felt that I had to keep going and fighting and fighting and fighting to purify the church. And I quit praying like I should have done because I couldn't stop thinking about the fight and bringing more and more journalistic power to the fight to call out the evil in our midst and cast it out. Eventually, I got to the place where I could no longer believe as a Catholic. I never imagined it would happen. I thought that as long as I had all the syllogisms straight in my head, my faith would be completely impregnable. I had not realized how incomplete my conversion was in my own heart and in my own life, the disciplines that I was not following in my life, the prayer disciplines. I had not realized how serious it was how seriously I needed to take the requirement to step back away from the fight. Because, you know, as I think Nietzsche said, if you stare into the abyss long enough, it stares into you. That's what happened to me. And so without even realizing what was happening one day, I just was so filled with anger and despair and fear that I couldn't hold on to my faith anymore. It was as if I'd been holding on to my faith in Christ through the Catholic Church with bare hands, and it was a skillet, an iron skillet on a stove that heated up so hot I had to drop it so my hands didn't burn up. It was the most painful thing that has ever happened to me, and I say that as someone who's buried his sister and his father, but losing my Catholic faith was the most painful thing. The Lord was merciful to me and brought me into Orthodoxy, but I became an Orthodox Christian with a very different frame of mind. The Lord broke me through his severe mercy. He broke my intellectual pride, and he broke the idea that I had lived by, that to fight for the Catholic faith meant to go out there and do combat, rhetorical combat, in the pages of the right magazines. It meant reading the right books and holding the right thoughts and getting behind the right bishops and all that. God broke me of that. So when I came into Orthodoxy, I had to make a resolution not to be that kind of Orthodox Christian. And I've tried to live by that. All of this came to mind. I wasn't even going to talk about that, but it came to mind this week. I ran into a friend of mine a Protestant friend, who's dealing with severe scandal in his own church. And some of it involves sexual abuse. He told me, "I understand better now, a lot better what you were going through in the early 2000s. So I asked him how he was getting through it with his faith intact. He told me that he had had to start practicing the habit of going out into the desert to pray, metaphorically. You know, he would stay in the fight, but he knew that if he stayed there in the fight constantly, he was going to burn out, and who knows what would happen. So he made it a habit of withdrawing to recharge himself, to pray, to contemplate, to be reminded of who we are, who he is as a Christian, and then go back out. For him, his periodic withdrawal, was not running away from the fight, but rather it was a strategic retreat so he could gather his strength so he could return to combat. Now, listening to my friend, I thought, you know what? That's what I should have done. Instead, when I was in the thick of a fight as a journalist writing about sex abuse, I felt that I had to carry on no matter what. That if I turned away for just one second, if I didn't take one more phone call or follow down this lead, I was going to let down the side. I was going to be a coward. So few other people were willing to go to the fight. I had to do this. And in the end, I burned out. I needed rest and contemplation. I was so given over to the labora, to the work, that I completely neglected the ora, the prayer, the contemplation. And that is a lesson that I would offer to everybody here, whatever your church is, about how to do this fight, how to live the Benedict option out, how to face the challenges that all of us have to face in the Christian life, in this post-Christian world. It is important to fight, but if you think the fight is waged by making the best arguments, by getting on sides on power struggles within a church, you're deceiving yourself, and you may find yourself, like me, completely helpless to believe what you had been given. And I was put to the test and wasn't ready for it, but I hope to God that I have learned from my failure how to meet the test better, because I know it's coming again. Now, this is why I appreciated so much the distinction that Douglas Farrow made in his talk here about the difference between cowardly retreat and strategic retreat. Sometimes I explain the Benedict option to people by using a Dunkirk analogy. I say, imagine that the church today is like the British Army on the beach at Dunkirk, pinned down by the Germans, you know, on the verge of being crushed. The choices we have: attack the Germans head on, we're going to get massacred. Sit quietly and hope the Germans just pass us by without noticing us, not going to happen. We're going to get massacred. There was a third option: to climb on this little flotilla of boats coming to us across the channel, climb aboard those boats, retreat to the relative safety of a metaphorical England, where we can rest, retrain, rearm, regroup, and prepare ourselves to go back into battle for D-Day. That's one way to think about the Benedict option, not as a cowardly retreat, but as a strategic retreat, because we are now being overwhelmed by the forces against us. And I'm not simply talking about hostile forces who are coming at us directly. I'm talking about simply living in a world as chaotic as ours is, when you get so many mixed messages all the time. It's dizzying, it's confusing, and we need strategic retreat to clear our own minds. Well, I bring up Douglas Farrar because he is a spiritual brother as a son of St. Benedict, and so far as everyone in this room is. I say in the Benedict option that this project is something that we are all going to have to collaborate on together across denominational lines. Now, I'm the sort of person for whom ecumenism is usually a bad word, one that connotes a casting aside of meaningful differences for the sake of false, happy-clappy unity. I don't believe in that kind of ecumenism. I'm talking instead about the touchstone kind of ecumenism, in which we acknowledge and embrace our doctrinal and ecclesiological distinctives and hold fast to them, even as we recognize and celebrate our deep commonality. In that sense, I want to share with you some of the most important lessons I've learned from my Benedictine brothers and sisters at this collaborative conference. In his talk about how unaware we believers today are of how profoundly the culture catechizes us, John Stone Street noted that people today have lost their ability to perceive reality. John said, quote, "Fundamentally, we don't know what it means to be human anymore. And if we don't know what it means to be human, how can we possibly know what it means to be Christian?" This is a hugely important point. One of the main functions of a Benedict option community of whatever kind is to help all of its members to keep clear eyes about reality. We can only see reality if our eyes are fixed on God. We cannot keep our eyes fixed on God if we do not discipline our eyes, or to use the old-fashioned Catholic phrase, have custody of our eyes. And we cannot keep our eyes fixed on God if we're not part of a community of believers who are striving for the same thing and can help us when our vision strays. The Benedictine monk is on a lifelong pilgrimage of constant conversion. All of the prayers, all of the fasting, all of the labors, the singing and scripture reading he does, it's all spiritual training to bring him to theosis, that is, to die ever more to himself, so that Christ can live in him. This has to be us too, even though we live outside the monastery. If we are not crystal clear on our Christian vision and how it stands against the world's, what makes it distinctive from the world's, and if we do not labor to keep our eyes on the prize, then we are going to be lost in this fog of confusion. I think fog is an important metaphor. Just recently, I was in Slovakia doing some research for this new book I'm working on. And a Slovak priest said that in some ways the crisis facing the church now is much more challenging than the crisis the church faced under communism. He said under communism, it was pretty black and white, and the light of faith shone a clear path through the darkness of communism. Now, though, when the light of faith shines out, it hits fog and is reflected back. And I think that that is a brilliant way to put the challenges we're facing now. And that makes it even more important that we discern together what where the Lord is calling us, and we fight for clarity of vision. John Stone Street said that the culture is not some abstract thing that exists out there, but it begins in our own backyard. Well, Leo Labresco Sargent is for me always the best reminder that the Benedict option begins with small deeds done faithfully. I'm going to leave this conference today with her lines in my head. Quote, "What can we do to build thicker Christian community in the next 2 or 3 months? Not waiting until you buy a house, not waiting until your children are big enough to talk." That's me. I'm the guy who always has these big thoughts about now we need to do this, we need to do that, but I never seem to get out of my chair. You know, I keep waiting for somebody else to do this thing. Well, reading Leah and Leah's book, if you don't have Billy the Benedict option, please don't leave here without it, because she makes it so practical. She makes us realize that, you know, we do face this massive battle, But the battle begins and the victory begins today. Christ has won the victory for us, and we bring in that victory, we claim that victory in our own lives when we do something as simple as inviting our neighbors over for a pot of macaroni and cheese. You know, in the Benedict Option book, I wrote about Václav Benda, the Czech dissident, Catholic dissident, who wrote about what we could do as Christians in a time and a place where we had no political power at all, as was the case in communist Czechoslovakia. Benda believed that no Christian had the excuse of turning in on himself, closing himself off from the world and his neighbors, and sitting in peace in his own house. Somehow politics, that is working for the common good, has to find a way to thrive even under those conditions where normal politics were impossible. So for Benda, a political act was something as simple as bringing his neighbors together for a meal or inviting them over to his house to talk about a book. Anything to remind people that they were there together, because the communist government, like all totalitarian governments, controlled things by keeping people atomized, by making them think that they were all alone in the face of this all-powerful government, by just helping people remember that they were people, they were somebody, and there was another way to see the world instead of the propaganda they were all fed, and that they were loved. These were radical political acts, and the man went to prison for them too. But these are things that we can do. We don't live in a police state, but we can do these things. It's a radical political act to have a fish fry or a crawfish boil. I was raised in a country and in a time I'm old enough to remember when having a fish fry or a crawfish boil was just what people did. Doesn't happen anymore. The little small town I grew up in, now everybody has satellite dishes. It's a lot harder for people to get out of the house and come over to somebody's house just to be a neighbor. So this is all part of building the Benedict Option too. It doesn't require having read the right theological text. It just requires being open to seeing Christ in your neighbor and wanting to share that communion. I cherish the line that Leah gave me in the book, The Benedict Option, when she said that all Rod Dreher am doing is calling on the church to be the church, but if you put it like that, people won't take it seriously. She's right about that. I have appreciated everybody's words about the different options that we believers can consider as we discern how best to live faithfully in the post-Christian world. I don't think of my project as Benedict versus everybody else. I'm happy to welcome and learn from input from creative minorities in any and all Christian traditions. I feel that I have a lot to learn from Dietrich Bonhoeffer, for example. So I don't restrict myself to just Orthodox saints or saints from the early church or Catholic saints. Any Christian who seeks to live faithfully in a time of trial is somebody who has something to teach me. But I do think that Saint Benedict himself must be our controlling metaphor. Let me explain why. I took the title of The Benedict Option from Alistair MacIntyre's final paragraph in After Virtue. You'll recall where MacIntyre says, he compares our time to the fall of the Roman Empire, and he highlighted Saint Benedict as somebody who exited the empire and figured out how to create a community within which the traditional values could be celebrated even as the Dark Ages came. And he ended by saying, we're waiting for a new and doubtless very different Saint Benedict. That's the Benedict Option. It's not fleeing to the monastery that recommended it to me, Saint Benedict to me, but MacIntyre is positing Benedict as a creative spiritual genius who read the signs of its times and who created a new way of living so that the traditions he had been given, most of all his faith in his Lord Jesus Christ, could be kept alive in the dark ages to come. Saint Benedict symbolizes strategic retreat, not just running away from something, but running towards something good. For Benedict, it was necessary to regather the spiritual forces that had been scattered widely by the collapse of Roman civilization. In his wonderful biography of St. Francis of Assisi, G.K. Chesterton talks about how God sends us the saints we need for the crises of our time. Chesterton said that what St. Benedict gathered, St. Francis scattered. Benedict was the paradigmatic saint of the early Middle Ages for a time of collapse. Francis and Dominic were the paradigmatic saints of the High Middle Ages when the collapse had been repaired and it was time to scatter those seeds again. Well, we are once again thrown into a time of gathering. This is why we need the Benedict option, not the Francis option, not to put St. Francis down or St. Dominic down in any way, but our time is one in which our spiritual forces have been widely scattered, and it's time to gather them in. As the historian Robert Louis Wilkin has said, and this has come up once already in this conference, it's more urgent now for the church to tell itself its own story and its children its own story than it is to tell the outside world about the gospel. It's not either or, it's both and, but we have to reprioritize learning our own story because living our own story out, because the knowledge of it has become dangerously thin, especially with the younger generations. I'm beginning to think that we need a new addendum to the Benedict option, the Kolakowicz option, which is to say a Benedict option for a time of serious persecution. Let me explain about this. This new book project I'm working on is about, I'm going to talk to Christians and some others, but mostly Christians, who lived under communism in the Soviet Union or in the Eastern Bloc, and who held on to the faith in a time of active persecution. What I want to know is, what lessons can we learn from them? Because I believe something that I call soft totalitarianism is coming to this country. It's what they have in China. We were talking about it earlier. I think some version of that is going to come to this country, especially as the country de-Christianizes. And I wanted to talk and do want to talk to believers who lived through hard totalitarianism to see how we need to prepare ourselves, both to resist it, to maybe stop it from coming, or if it does come, how to live faithfully in this time. I learned this summer in Slovakia about an amazing priest, a man named Father Tomislav Kolakowicz. I know I've talked to some of you about this, but briefly, he was a Croatian Jesuit who escaped Zagreb in 1943, where he was organizing Catholic resistance to the Nazis. He got a tip that the Gestapo was coming for him. He went to Slovakia, told the Catholics there, listen, the Nazis are going to lose this war, but when the war is over, the communists are going to rule this country. We've got to get ready for it. So he began founding little cells. He called them his family. They were cells of faithful Catholics, usually young people, who got together for prayer, for Bible study, to work together and to learn the techniques of resistance. 5 years after his prediction, communism took over Czechoslovakia in 1948. In Slovakia, the underground church was Father Kolakowicz's disciples. A lot of them, he trained about 300 people, a lot of them went to prison, but they were the ones who built the structure of the underground church, who kept the faith alive under intense persecution. Their stories, I was so privileged to learn them, but I thought, my God, this is what we need now. We need a new and perhaps quite different Father Tomislav Kolakowicz. I went this summer, I was taken by one of his spiritual children into a room underneath a basement behind a secret wall in a suburban house in Bratislava. In this secret room, you had to go into a tunnel to get to it, there was a mimeograph machine where they made samizdat. They made illegal prayer books and catechisms and things like that to distribute to keep the faith alive. The men and women who participated in this project risked their lives and risked prison to keep the gospel alive. That particular machine, it's still there. They told me that it came to them because some evangelical Protestant brothers in the West had smuggled it into them so those Catholics could publish their prayer books and their catechisms. That's the kind of brotherhood and sisterhood that we need today before things get too bad. One of the lessons that is coming out to me so clearly from talking to all these Christians who suffered persecution under communism is the power of small groups. Jan Simulcik is a historian today in Slovakia, and he was also a member of one of these groups. He was the one who had come to that house and with four other young men who were part of his cell and gathered the samizdat and distributed it. He had no idea until after communism was over that the samizdat was being printed in a secret room beneath the basement. That's because they kept themselves uninformed for the sake of protection. So if they were captured, they wouldn't be able to rat out their colleagues. Jan told me that those that the Lord was the one that sustained him most of all, of course, but it was also the fellowship with those four men, because they all knew what they were risking for the sake of the gospel. Jan told me that they did that for 8 years, and then the underground church in 1988 called for what is now known as the candlelight demonstration. They gathered everybody in the central square of Bratislava, the capital of Slovakia, with candles to pray and sing hymns. The communists didn't see it coming. You can see video online of the government coming in with water cannons to disperse it all. Jan was there. He said that if it had not been for that 8 years of fellowship and taking risks and praying with those four other young men in his circle, he wouldn't have had the courage to go out there on the square and proclaim his faith when it was necessary. So one thing I'm going to be writing about in the new book as part of the Benedict Option, the next stage, is the deep importance of building these small, intensely committed circles. And when I was out in Poland this summer researching the new book, I was reminded of something the philosopher Michael Hanby told me when I started to write the Benedict Option. Michael Hanby, I asked him for some basic advice as I was beginning to write, and he said, "I would just say you should ask yourself, what would Wojtyla do?" What do you mean? He told me about how when the Nazis invaded Poland, they were very clear about what they wanted to do: destroy the Polish nation, completely destroy it. And that meant destroying its Catholic faith and destroying its conception of itself as a nation and its history. Wojtyla and his circle decided the way they could best resist would be to write and perform plays on Polish nationalist themes and on Catholic themes. So what they did all this underground, and the people who came to see these plays, it was all very secret. They would come there and would watch the drama. If the Gestapo discovered what they were doing, all of them, the patrons and the actors, would have been taken to the concentration camp. Thank God it never happened. But this was their form of resistance, through protecting cultural memory. Professor Hanby says this is what we need today in our very different circumstances. We need to be bold and brave and creative in setting up structures and doing things that will preserve our cultural memory of what it means to be Christian. In that sense, we're doing important battle when we homeschool or when we start new schools. We're doing important battles when we read to our children. Václav Benda, the man I wrote about, the dissident in Prague, he and his wife, Camilla, she's still alive. I visited her in her apartment, and they raised six children to be faithful Catholics, not only under communist persecution, but under the liberal capitalism that came after the end of communism, which was itself a threat to their Catholicism. The Czech Republic is the most atheist country in Western Europe. I asked Camilla and some of her adult children, how did you do this? How did you raise these faithful children? And now they have grandchildren who are all still faithful Catholics. They said there were two basic things they did. One thing, Václav, the dad, would teach the kids how to regard the world critically. When they would come home from school, they had to go to the communist schools. He would just sit down with them and talk to them about how was your day and help them learn to discern truth from falsehood by the light of the Catholic Church and by reason, because they were living in a propaganda state. But Camilla, she read to the kids. She would read to them for 2 hours a day, and their house, their apartment is full of books. And she said even when Václav was in prison and she was raising all these kids and teaching classes, she's a philosophy professor, she still read to him. I said, what did you read, Camilla? She said, mostly fairy tales. And I read a lot of Tolkien to him. I said, why Tolkien? She looked at me and said, because we knew that Mordor was real. So she did what Professor Esselin was telling us to do. She fed the imagination of her kids to keep the cultural memory alive of what civilization was and what the Catholic faith is, even against the communists and against the secularists and the atheists. This is a war we're all in that is going to last far longer than anyone in this room does. We have to be patient because we are building today for people that we'll never know. I want to leave you today with these remarks from Cardinal John Henry Newman, who will be canonized tomorrow by the Catholic Church. In this passage, Newman writes about the effects that the early Benedictine monks had on healing a world torn apart by violence and chaos. Newman wrote, When the bodily frame receives an injury or is seized with some sudden malady, nature may be expected to set right the evil if left to itself, but she requires time. Science comes in to shorten the process and is violent that it may be certain. This may be taken to illustrate St. Benedict's mode of counteracting the miseries of life. He found the world, physical and social, in ruins, and his mission was to restore it in the way not of science, but of nature, not as if setting about to do it, not professing to do it by any set time or by any rare specific or by any series of strokes, but so quietly, patiently, gradually, that often, till the work was done, it was not known to be doing. It was a restoration rather than a visitation, correction, or conversion. The new world which he helped to create was a growth rather than a structure. Silent men were observed about the country or discovered in the forest, digging, clearing, and building. And other silent men, not seen, were sitting in the cold cloister, tiring their eyes and keeping their attention on the stretch, while they painfully deciphered, copied, and recopied the manuscripts which they had saved. There was no one that contended or cried out or drew attention to what was going on, but by degrees, the woody swamp became a hermitage, a religious house, a farm, an abbey, a village, a seminary, a school of learning, and a city. Roads and bridges connected it with other abbeys and cities, which had similarly grown up, and what the haughty Alaric or the fierce Attila had broken to pieces, these patient, meditative men had brought together and made to live again. And then, when they had in the course of many years gained their peaceful victories, perhaps some new invader came, and with fire and sword undid their slow and persevering toil in an hour. The Hun succeeded to the Goth, the Lombard to the Hun, the Tartar to the Lombard. The Saxon was reclaimed only that the Dane might take his place. Down in the dust lay the labor and civilization of centuries, churches, colleges, cloisters, libraries, and nothing was left to them, to the monks, but to begin all over again. But this they did without grudging, so promptly, cheerfully, and tranquilly, as if it were by some law of nature that the restoration came. And they were like the flowers and shrubs and fruit trees, which they reared, and which, when ill-treated, do not take vengeance or remember evil, but give forth fresh branches, leaves, or blossoms, perhaps in greater profusion and with richer quality, for the very reason that the old were rudely broken off. If one holy place was desecrated, the monks pitched upon another, and by this time there were rich or powerful men who remembered and loved the past enough to wish to have it restored in the future. That's the end of Newman's quote. There's a Benedictine quality of stability there. You know, the Benedictines make a vow of stability, meaning that they're going to stay in that monastery where they make their first profession until they die, absent something unusual. Russ Hittinger told me once that stability had a lot to do with the conversion of the peasantry of the early Middle Ages. Barbarians would sweep in, as Cardinal Newman said, wipe out the monastery, but the mother house would send more monks and rebuild. The peasants watching this learned that those monks would not abandon them, and then they moved to live around the monasteries because they knew that the monasteries were places of order, places of light, places of prayer, stability and mercy, and indeed love in a world that had very little of any of that. So to return to the questions raised by Cardinal Newman's passage, Do we here love the past enough to wish to have it restored to the future? Are we willing to put our riches of our time and our financial resources and our social networks to achieve that task? Are we willing to be patient and steadfast against the attacks of the modern barbarians? Are we willing to show stability and hospitality to a world desperate for it? Do we love God so much that we will prefer nothing to the search for Him? If so, we can build a Benedict option that will be a lighthouse in the darkness, an ark on the dark and stormy sea, a haven in a heartless world. If not, well, what else is there? You tell me, because if we continue to live this way, we as a Christian people are going to die out. Our Lord promised that the gates of hell would not prevail against His church, but He did not promise that the gates of hell would not prevail against His church in the United States of America. That is up to all of us. Thank you. Thank you very much.